At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Economic growth reported this week for a change, vaccine shortages, and the Secretary of State talks tough in Pakistan. The U.S. economy grew at a 3.5% rate last quarter. The president hailed the numbers.
This is obviously welcome news and affirmation that this recession is abating and the steps we've taken have made a difference.
Americans in line this week for an H1N1 flu shot. Many turned away. Here's one mom in line.
It's hard to be patient when your kids, you know, you're worried about them getting sick.
And Hillary Clinton in the country says she can't believe Pakistan couldn't catch Al-Qaeda if it wanted to.
The Pakistanis have talked about a trust deficit, and it's a two-way street. We have questions, they have questions, we need to be responding, and we need to be as open as possible.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Growth up, consumer confidence down. How do you read the economy? The death toll in Afghanistan, the House health bill, and Joe Lieberman. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Ann Kornblut, White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Her forthcoming book is Notes from the Cracked Ceiling, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and What It Will Take for a Woman to Win. Ann Kornblut, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Also from Washington is Howard Fineman, senior Washington correspondent and columnist for Newsweek. His latest book out in paperback is The 13 Arguments. Howard, great to have you with us as well.
Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ann, and Howard.
Let's go first to Hillary Clinton, if we may. She talked cooperative before she talked tough. Here she is after the car bomb that marred her arrival in Peshawar at the beginning of her visit Wednesday.
These attacks may be happening on your territory, but this is not your fight alone.
Howard Fineman, what do you read in Hillary Clinton in Pakistan this week? Is it representative of frustration right through this administration? Where does it leave this relationship?
Well, it leaves the relationship where it's been, which is difficult, contentious, but absolutely crucial. I think the administration is concerned that Pakistan is not doing enough. They want it to do more because the administration is looking for a regional solution. They call it AFPAC, meaning Afghanistan and Pakistan, and Hillary was there to express her concern about the PAC portion of it.
And meanwhile, back at the White House, what about the long consideration of what to do with troops and Afghanistan? Where does that stand? We're told, what, a last meeting today in the Situation Room? Is there a schedule, a calendar for a decision here? Where does it stand, Ann?
Well, we've heard the last meeting line before. There were five meetings prior to this where the president met with his war council, as they've called it, a rather large war council up till today. Today, it's a much smaller group. It's really with the decision makers and a lot of the military officials who are helping him figure this out. They are still saying that it's weeks away, the weeks away until he announces what his decision is, whether to send more troops, whether to shift the strategy. But they are acknowledging that he's sort of at the end of the decision-making process. The rollout, by the way, the whole decision-making process has been extraordinary. We've seen them do it semi-in public. This is not something that we would have seen in the previous administration. But the rollout of this decision is going to be complicated somewhat by the fact that the president leaves for Asia in a couple of weeks and will be gone for about 9 days. So it's either going to come before he leaves on November 10th or it will come after. And at this point, nobody in the White House is saying which.
Tough for the country to watch and wait while we had, 14 dead Americans one day this week, 8 dead Americans on another day. President Obama was in Jacksonville, Florida, talking with service members there, kind of explaining why he's taking his time on his decision on a troop surge.
I also promise you this, and this is very important as we consider our next steps in Afghanistan. I will never rush the solemn decision of sending you into harm's way. I won't risk your lives unless it is absolutely necessary. And if it is necessary, we will back you up to the hilt, because you deserve the strategy, the clear mission, and the defined goals, as well as the equipment and support that you need to get the job done.
Okay, but what's the job? Jack, what do you make of the calendar here? It is stretching out. Vice President Dick Cheney, the former, saying, dithering. A lot of people came down on him, but it's a long time here.
It is. The optics aren't politically auspicious for the president, I don't think. And it was caught recently by a New York Times headline. It was under a story. It was an interview with David Miliband, the British Foreign Secretary. The headline in the New York Times, this is about Afghanistan, Britain resolves U.S. waivers. That's not the kind of headline that we're used to seeing. And it's obvious why the president doesn't want to make a rapid decision. Who would want to with so much at stake? I'm only glad that he made his midnight vigil to Dover Air Base Wednesday night, to steep himself in the consequences of any decision he may make, to see it, to be right there. You know, Michael Beschloss, the historian, said that Lincoln, during his summers, would take a house out on the fringe of Washington, and right across the street was a cemetery where pretty much every day more Union soldiers would be buried. And Lincoln said, well, it was right for him to look at those graves because those men were dying because of his decision.
Here was President Obama the day after his overnight visit to Dover Air Force Base. 18 flag-covered caskets came off the big transport there. Here's the president.
It was a sobering reminder of the extraordinary sacrifices that our young men and women in uniform are engaging in every single day.
Howard Feynman, step back on this whole Afghanistan picture with us for a second here. It does seem to be a long time now. The death toll, highest single-month death toll in Afghanistan ever this month, and big numbers on particular days this week. The president honoring war dead, and at the same time, this is really going on a long time. How do you read what's happening here? We hear reports of a province-by-province analysis. Is that what it takes for a president to make a decision in this situation?
Well, President Obama, when he was a candidate during the campaign, stressed Afghanistan and said it was more important, really, in the long run than Iraq. And then in March, he gave a speech calling Afghanistan the necessary war, or a necessary war. Now he's facing up to the consequences of having said that and decisions he's already made to amplify the number of troops there, up to 68,000 are heading in that direction, and there's talk of going much farther. One problem that he's got in the timing, and Ann alluded to this about early November, is that there's going to be another election in Afghanistan, and it's
sort
been
of do-over.
Complicated. A do-over that will take place on November 7th, right in the middle of this process. So one reason they're waiting, I think, is to see what happens in that election, which will also be disputed, which is also going to be difficult. The United Nations people who were out there to observe and to help and to see what they could do to bring order to the country are now staying in their barracks, if you will, or in their offices because of bombings in Kabul. The situation has gotten more complicated by the minute, and that makes the president's decision-making that much harder. I think they've been making it clear through leaks and other signals that no quick withdrawal is contemplated. So while this is an argument, it seems to me to be an argument behind the scenes more about how much to further increase the troop levels, and the rationale that he's going to offer, because the key is the rationale. He has another chance to go before the American people, which he's going to have to do, and explain himself. And the rationale and the strategy, as he said to those soldiers, has to be very, very clear. Exactly what is our plan there, and what is our goal?
Meanwhile, the complications pile up there, however. I mean, this week we had Matthew Ho, regional official there, former U.S. Marine captain, became the first Foreign Service official to publicly resign in protest over the war in Afghanistan. Here he tells NPR's Melissa Block that staying in the country, in the one Marine's view, is not in America's interest.
I'm not so much concerned about the how of the war. I'm not so much concerned about debating General McChrystal's views or any of the views of the folks here in D.C., that think tank crowd. I'm more concerned about why we're in Afghanistan. Why are we losing soldiers and Marines in combat to people who are fighting us, really only because we're occupying them? Why are we supporting an Afghan government who, if we are successful in stabilizing it, that stabilization won't defeat al-Qaeda?
Matthew Ho, former Marine captain, State Department employee, very public resignation this week. His full resignation letter, it's very interesting, is up at our website, onpointradio.org. And Kornblut, that cannot have been a happy, it's a small step, but a crack in the front here. Everybody tried to rush in and hire the guy, including, we read, Richard Holbrooke, but he's not staying on. He says he doesn't understand the rationale.
Well, that's correct. Holbrooke asked him if he didn't want to be in Afghanistan, could he come back to Washington and fight the fight from within to try and solve this? And he said no. He said he would. And then a week later, he said no, he didn't want to do that either. Of course, all of the officials involved point out this is just one person, not necessarily a larger trend. But I think what's interesting is that the case he's making is a case that's actually being made inside the White House as they try to figure out this strategy. It has echoes of Vietnam, of course, but they're trying to figure out, even after the runoff on November 7th that Howard mentioned, will there be a credible government, not just one that's been validated by the runoff, but one that actually is going to do the work of standing up the military? And Matthew Ho's argument here is one that they're actually taking seriously, that they're not sure why they're there, that in fact, if there's only 100 al-Qaeda members left in Afghanistan, that al-Qaeda's really in Pakistan now, well, why are they there? What's the ratio of soldiers to al-Qaeda under that scenario? That's why you see Obama asking for the study of each province, trying to figure out where can they leave the security to the regional officials, how much can they rely on the national government and Afghanistan, and how little of a U.S. force can they leave there and still keep the country safe?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour. A quarter of growth. Hillary calls out Pakistan in Pakistan. The House delivers its health package. And Kornblut is here from the Washington Post, White House correspondent there, author of the forthcoming Notes from the Cracked Ceiling. Howard Fineman's with us, senior Washington correspondent and columnist for Newsweek. The 13 American Arguments is his book now out in paperback. Jack Beatty's here. Let's go to Buffalo and Jay calling in. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking the call.
Yeah.
I'd just like to offer a little bit different definition on what asymmetrical warfare is here. Isn't it? Couldn't we consider it as spending billions of dollars to kill per year to spend to kill a $50 a year Al Qaeda suspect, and there's only 100 of them? There's got to be a better way to isolate these people and a better way to run this war or this war.
There's a dollar sign asymmetry there in addition to everything else. Jay, thanks. Jack Beatty, that's one of the things that Matthew Ho pointed out in his resignation letter.
It is indeed. He says, we are mortgaging our nation's economy on a war, which, even with increased commitment, will remain a draw for years to come. And he gets right at this, the sort of absurdity. Why are we spending all this money and, my gosh, losing these lives here? And he said, if honest, our stated strategy of securing Afghanistan to prevent al-Qaeda resurgence or regrouping would require us additionally to invade and occupy Western Pakistan, Somalia, Sudan, Yemen, etc. There it is, the reductio ad absurdum of the rationale we're there to get al-Qaeda. Well, al-Qaeda is in these places, too.
And Matthew Ho is out of there. Of course, all this stacked up against the financial picture, and we've got reports of 3.5% growth in the third quarter, and that is not too bad. Certainly a lot better than what we've had in the deep, deep trough, the worst in seven decades the U.S. has been in. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said the economy is on the mend but remains fragile. Here he is at a congressional hearing yesterday.
Business and consumer confidence has improved substantially since the end of last year. House prices are rising. The value of American savings have increased substantially. Americans are now saving more, and we are borrowing much less from the rest of the world.
Howard Fineman, that's a great number for them to look at. Of course, there's a lot of cash for clunkers and stimulus money stuffed in there. I mean, what are you seeing and hearing? Do people look at this as some kind of solid footing? It doesn't look great against the consumer spending numbers that have just come out.
Well, first, let's consider the possibility, consider what would have happened had the money been spent on the cash for clunkers and the stimulus package and all the printing of dollars by the Fed and everything else, and there weren't a decent growth number. So we could at least be relieved that that
absolutely
spending by the government did something.
Yes.
But we can't, it's as though, you know, we placed the paddles, those electric paddles on the chest and,
thump,
and
thump.
You know, mm-hmm. thump, thump, and we sprang back to life. But we can't live that way. Our heart has to beat on its own, and that's the problem that we face going forward. Naturally, Geithner didn't stress that, although I thought the president's tone in this was very careful. He used the word, the recession is abating. And that's not triumphalist language, and I think that's smart on his part, because if anything, the unemployment number is going to continue to go up. The number of mortgage foreclosures is going to continue to be unconscionably high. Mm. And the contrast between the money being made on Wall Street again and the fees being charged by the banks are just rubbing salt in the wounds of the average American.
Christina Romer, Obama economic advisor, was pretty candid about exactly where we stand. She said this is just one milestone, a welcome one, but on a long road to travel. Here's Romer talking about the 3.5% growth in the third quarter.
The Recovery Act was adding somewhere between 3 and 4 percentage points to real GDP growth. And that was in the third quarter. So that gives you a sense that if we're seeing 3.5% real growth this quarter without the Recovery Act, we could be seeing 0 or even a negative number.
And that would really hurt, but it's not there. The stimulus is out there, cash for clunkers and all the rest. And Kornblut, do you sense relief in the White House on this number, or, you know, more, I don't know, just gritty determination? There's still a lot of obstacles out there, as Howard says.
Well, and I think Howard's right. I think that they are rejoicing, if they are rejoicing, behind closed doors, because this is just one figure that could easily be undercut if the unemployment rate continues to rise. And I think there's some expectation that it might, or at least that it's not going to go down significantly. In electoral terms for them, they are looking ahead. You know, next Tuesday is an election day, mm-hmm. And that's sort of the unofficial marker for looking ahead to next year's midterms. And that's the real benchmark for them. And as they go into those midterms, it doesn't matter how much GDP improves, that doesn't mean anything to somebody who's unemployed. So they're really looking for the unemployment rate and to see some results from all the spending that they've been doing continue more than just 1 month. I would expect to see them continuing to talk about the jobs that have been not only created but also saved. This is their term, saved or created jobs. And over the next few days, over the next week or so, I think we're going to hear them talking about trying to really break down the numbers of how the spending has worked out.
How about that election next week? We've got some interesting races there for governor in Virginia and New Jersey, an interesting congressional race in upstate New York. Howard, have you been following that? Republicans and the conservative party in up to their hips and kind of fighting here.
Yeah, I think in many ways that's the most interesting race on Tuesday. The Republicans, the establishment Republicans, thought they were smart by picking a moderate to liberal Republican, and if they're going to be such animals, they exist only in places like New York State.
23rd however, District.
Mm. 23rd District in upstate New York. However, Doug Hoffman, the conservative, has come on roaring to the front and is, I think, probably going to win that race. And I think it's remarkable, and it doesn't mean a resurgence of the conservative movement of the Republican Party necessarily, as much as he's the outsider guy. He's the protest vote. He's the protest candidacy at a time when Obama's initial popularity notwithstanding, people are extremely skeptical about all powers that be, including powers in Washington. And I think that's what the message of Hoffman's victory would be.
Jack, you've got a lot of very high-profile Republicans stepping in here to endorse the candidate who's not the GOP candidate, but rather the conservative party. Really interesting here in New York's 23rd upstate.
Yes, including at least two putative presidential contenders for the Republican nomination. That would be Tim Pawlenty and Sarah Palin. But on the other side, endorsing the Orthodox candidate is another putative Republican nominee, Newt Gingrich. So, yes, it's become quite an exemplum of the Republican dilemma. You know, I mean, I really think there – I wonder what Howard thinks about this, but the Republicans have a dilemma with their conservatism sometimes looks as though it's going to eat the party, destroy the party, that the ideology, which has sort of been in sync with the party, not always, but roughly, is now threatening it.
What do you say, Howard?
I think that's right, and I think that's why you can look for a Republican nominee down the road, and certainly a Republican conversation that's going to be very anti-establishment, including against the establishment and its own party. That's Sarah Palin, Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota, is going to try to run that way. I thought it was interesting that Newt Gingrich, who may have lost his fingertip feel for the revolutionary sentiment in his party, endorsed the establishment person. I think he was way wrong on that this time.
And Democrats have their own issues in Virginia and New Jersey. What do you see coming in those gubernatorial races?
Well, that's right. I mean, I think before we begin declaring the death of either kind, certainly moderate Republicans, we have to look no further than Virginia, where the Republican nominee for governor is well ahead, is widely expected to win, beating Creed Deeds, who's the Democratic nominee, in a state where Obama won in 2008 and the Democrats largely felt had turned the state somewhat blue. It looks like it's not that way. And I think what we've seen is a Republican who's run a fairly moderate campaign, doing quite well and looking like he's going to not only win, but also help the down-ticket Republicans win, so the lieutenant governor and in some of the state legislature races. New Jersey is very close at this point, and I think the White House is really bracing itself for a sweep of potentially bad news on Tuesday if they not only lose in New York, which may or may not happen, and lose in Virginia, but also if it's very close to New Jersey. That's all it's all we have to look at going ahead into the midterm. So they're looking at that very carefully right now.
John Corzine may be in trouble there in New Jersey. Let's go to Kingstree, South Carolina. Patrick, you're on the air.
Okay. Hello. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I feel that the basic problem with healthcare, with the economy, is the fact that the right wing is doing everything it can to block just about everything that the president wants to do. And I think that what we need is more dialogue, reconciliation. And I'm, you know, very disturbed to hear that the candidates that are going to come forward for the Republicans are not going to be, well, maybe they are not going to be ones who will be willing to work with Democrats, moderate Democrats. I'm a moderate Democrat. I'm an Obama Democrat. And I would like to see, if we had more dialogue, maybe we could get something done on health care.
Patrick, let us pick it up. Not a whole lot of that this week, though we do have in the House, a health care bill. Howard, I mean, it was just Olympia snow in the Senate there. How's it look in the House? Is there any crack in the wall of opposition on the GOP side to what's coming?
Not that I can sense. And the bill that Nancy Pelosi unveiled this week is a Democrats-only project, obviously. She's the Speaker and a Democrat, and they were dealing among themselves to try to cobble together a majority on the House side for a compromise measure. It took 1,900 pages to do it, but I think they've done it, and I think the slow, steady accretion of consensus on the Democratic side is going to be the story. I think in the end, they'll dare a few Republicans to say no. I bet you in the end, this is just strictly a guess on my part, that in the end, Olympia Snowe will come with the Democrats, even though they didn't give her what she says she wanted. But there won't be many Republicans. She might be the only one.
Here's Pelosi yesterday, after all these months of deal-making and debate. 10-year, $894 billion health reform bill out of the House now. Here she's announcing it on the Capitol steps, that it will expand coverage to almost all Americans, reform the insurance industry, reduce the budget deficit over the next two decades.
The bill is fiscally sound, will not add one dime to the deficit as it expands coverage, implements key insurance reforms, and promotes prevention and wellness across the health system. The bill will expand coverage, including a public option to boost choice and competition in the health insurance reform.
There's the rallying cry from Nancy Pelosi. House Minority Leader Republican John Boehner came out swinging. You can hear his chief talking point right here.
Nothing really has changed over these last couple of months. And yet the Democrats come forward with a bill that really is a government takeover of our health care system. It's not just the so-called government option. It's the over 50 new mandates, bureaucracies, tax hikes, commissions. All of this is this going to require tens of thousands of new federal employees, which is clearly designed for a government takeover of our health care system.
John Boehner comes out slugging. Ann Kornblut, how's the Obama administration watching this unfold from the White House? Do they think they've got a winner here, something too compromised to crow about? Are they confident something will go through?
Well, it's interesting listening to John Boehner's comments. One thing has actually changed in recent months. The political landscape maybe hasn't all that much. They've had only, as Howard mentioned, one Republican come on mm-hmm. board for any part of it. But in terms of the public perception, we've seen the popularity grow, and particularly when it's with regards to the public option. People seem much more open to it, especially when it's explained to them, defined for them, not as a government-run option, but as a competition, as something that only people without insurance through their workplace could get. So the White House does feel much more confident that the public is receptive to this, that they actually want it. And at this point, they believe that it may, you know, Congress has obviously fallen far behind the deadline that Obama initially set. This was supposed to happen back in August, mm-hmm. if you remember. But they do feel that they will probably get something out of the Senate, out of the House by, I'd say, Christmas is the very conservative guess at this point.
But Howard, there is now Connecticut's Joe Lieberman standing saying he'll vote for a filibuster. Is it still tight enough that one senator from Connecticut, Joe Lieberman, with his particular coloring, could stand in the way of this thing?
Well, there may be more than one filibuster vote. It isn't entirely clear to me that Lieberman would vote not to allow the bill to be taken up. That'll be the key vote. I think Harry Reid is confident, and I think rightly so, that if he can get the bill, the Senate bill, on the floor, then they can lose some Democrats, they can bargain, they can negotiate, they can twist and turn till they get the majority they need. They wouldn't need 60 necessarily at that point. And so Lieberman is one of many votes that are still up in the air. There's also some game playing going on here and negotiating going on. Mm. Different people from different states have things that they need for their local industries, whether it's the insurance industry in Connecticut or the medical equipment manufacturing industry in Indiana, which is something that Senator Evan Bayh is really concerned mm-hmm. about, even Senator Al Franken in Minnesota. They'll be negotiating, lots and lots of negotiating. But it seems to me pretty clear that the parameters of this thing are basically set, and there is going to be a bill. Ann is right. It's going to take probably till Christmas. This might be a Christmas Eve thing, but they're going to get it done.
Here's Joe Lieberman
notwithstanding.
Notwithstanding, maybe Harry Reid had a little bit of that tone in his comments. This was a Tuesday, Howard, talking about Joe Lieberman's declaration that he would vote with Republicans to filibuster the health reform bill.
I have the greatest confidence in Joe Lieberman's ability as a legislator, and he will work with us when this gets on the floor, and I'm sure he'll have some interesting things to do in the way of amendments, but Joe Lieberman is the least of Harry Reid's problems.
Jack Beatty, what do you make of the Lieberman stand here?
Well, you know, if he really means to stop the bill, I don't see it politically. I see it in terms of campaign contributions. He represents insurance companies. But politically, I mean, polls in Connecticut show strong support for the public option. And it's just the public option he says he wants to filibuster. And the grounds he's giving don't make sense. He says he's against the public option because it will increase the deficit. Well, we've just heard from the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, that's not so, that the element in the bill that is most likely to reduce the deficit is, in fact, the public option. So he's not even quite making sense with what with his rationale. So I don't have a read on Senator Lieberman on this, there, unless it's an appeal to get on Meet the Press, and I think that's probably forthcoming.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, NASA, big early snow, and one more time, the king of pop. There was liftoff for a new test rocket. Destination unclear.
Three, 3, 2, 1. Ignition. Liftoff of Ares 1X. Testing concepts for the future of new rocket design.
But to where? Rocky Mountain towns like Golden, Colorado saw a huge October snowfall.
I do believe we got at least 2 feet of snow in Golden, and I've been shoveling off and on all day long since 7 this morning.
And Michael Jackson's swan song movie, This Is It, hits the theaters.
A song for love. L-O-V-E. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. L-O-V-E, and off he goes. You can join the conversation. Ann Kornblut's here from the Washington Post. Howard Feynman from Newsweek and Jack Beatty. Are you hunting for H1N1 vaccine? What do you make of the fact that it's not there? What's up with collapsing bridges this week? San Francisco, Lake Champlain. What's up with our new skinny NASA rocket to nowhere? Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Dennis, you're on the air.
Thanks for having me on.
Hi.
I have several comments to make, but I wanted to just say that I'm paying on this health care bill that's going before the Congress. It has the public option in it, but what I have heard is that with this public option, it would only be available to people who are currently uninsured. Is that correct?
Help me, Howard, Jack, Ann. Currently uninsured, or whenever they become uninsured, or whenever they want it?
Go ahead, Jack. No, you're after you.
Howard.
No, it's for people who aren't part of the system at this point and who wouldn't be eligible under an expanded Medicaid program. One of the things they're going to do to cover more people, and the House bill says it would cover 96% of the legal residents in the country, it will expand Medicaid. But for those people who aren't eligible under Medicaid or who aren't currently employed with an employer who offers health care, those are the people who would be eligible for the new public option program.
Dennis,
there again. Yes.
Sorry, Dennis, are you for it or do you welcome it?
I welcome that, of course, for anyone who is in that position. But what I'm wondering, I mean, I'm paying $470 a month for health insurance right now. So this public option won't benefit me at all because I'm already insured. But I just think that the insurance companies have had it their way for far too long and that we're grossly overpaying for insurance. I have a friend of mine that works for a major insurance company. She's not an executive. She's not a boss or supervisor. She's pulling down a six-figure income. Come on, people. I mean, how much money do people who work for these insurance companies have to make? It does not get to the point to where we're paying premiums so that they can live like kings. And it just seems ridiculous to me.
Dennis, we've got it loud and clear. And, Jack, this is interesting. This goes to, I mean, all this debate, all this struggle on Capitol Hill, ultimately, though, it's going to sit right out there in front of everyone. And it may or may not satisfy an awful lot of Americans when this thing finally hits the pavement. This is not a panacea.
Not at all. You know, in 1993-94, Bill Kristol wrote a famous memo to Republicans, and he said, vote against this bill, not because it won't work, that is Clinton care, but because it might well work. And if it does, we'll lose voters. It'll be a new Social Security. We'll just be wiped out for years because the Democrats will essentially have dished us. Well, I don't know that that calculation is quite – I don't know that Bill Kristol is going to write that memo today. I think if he were writing it, he'd say, let the bill pass, because at least for the 2010 election, there's not going to be much good that the Democrats can show they have done for people. And perhaps even before the 2012 election, there won't be. Much of this isn't really going to happen until 2013. And in the meantime, we're going to have year after year, speech after speech, of Republicans saying taxes, and taxes are going up, taxes are going up. And I think it could well be a very I think it's good public policy, it could be bad politics.
And Kornblut, Barack Obama's put a lot of chips on this square. Do you think it looks like a payoff for him if it gets through? Maybe Christmas Eve, who knows?
Oh, absolutely. It would be his first big victory. And if he doesn't get it off, I actually think that's where the danger would be. He really needs this to happen. And I think at this point, they expect it will. I think Jack raises the right point, though, which is that he'll have a political victory, but then the effects of it won't be felt. This is not going to be like Medicare Part D, where people actually saw the prescription drug benefit pretty soon, a couple of years later, and were able to see that, okay, it was something they were skeptical of, but in the end worked. This is going to be something that if it starts to work, if it starts to really seep out into the public, it's not going to happen until after the next presidential election.
That's a long cycle, and a lot of opinions will be formed in that long time. Let's go to Josh in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Josh, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah. Regarding the economy again, despite today's numbers, I don't think we're in sustainable growth yet, but I think we'll be in self-sustainable without the government growth by first or second quarter next year. However, I haven't seen anything from the White House or from Congress that will do anything to stop the bubble and bust cycle that we've been in the past two decades, ever since Reagan and Carter, basically. They're not. You see that the Wall Street bonuses are going to be even better next year than they were last year. This is all just the same short-term philosophy, and right now it looks like the next bubble is going to be Treasury bills. If that one pops, we have nothing to recover to.
That would be painful. A lot of talk about whether or not we're sort of nipping that cycle in the bud this week, especially when it comes to too-big-to-fail banks. Josh, let me play a little tape right here from the congressional hearing yesterday. This is Congressman Brad Sherman, Democrat, California, one of several legislators raising big issues about proposed reforms for the financial sector. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, who was testifying, House Financial Services Committee Barney Frank are pushing for new rules. Sherman said he says they'll open the door for more bailouts.
Unfortunately, you've got in here what I call TARP on steroids. You've got permanent, unlimited bailout authority. This is the most unprecedented transfer of power to the executive branch to make decisions about both spending and taxes in history, all without congressional approval, and a sharp departure from our constitutional values.
There's the congressman saying this is TARP on steroids. Howard, have you been following what Barney Frank and Tim Geithner are up to here? They're saying that if we get into a big problem again with big banks, they're going to tap a whole lot of other financial institutions to pay up to bail out, but that's not satisfying a lot of folks.
Well, that was a remarkable statement by the congressman there, and I think there's some truth to it. I think it's the natural tendency of government and of officials to try to take the fail out of fail-safe. And we now have a global economy, and the ability of the American government to protect the American economy relies on global answers and big think. If you're going to be serious about it, it's no longer just a matter of bank regulation in the United States and reviving the old Glass-Steagall Act that separated banks from investment companies. I mean, we're dealing with a huge global tsunami-like flows of capital, and you have these people in Washington thinking that there's some way to tame those flows. I don't know if it's possible, but it's natural that they would think of doing so, and whether there are constitutional issues there involved is a very, very interesting question that I'm sure we're going to explore.
Well, I'm sure we will. We'll have Congressman Sherman and Barney Frank on the show on Monday to look at this, but let's hear a little bit from Chairman Frank. He was defending the proposed reform regulation, said that financial institutions that get in trouble again won't be bailed out by the taxpayers next time.
This is a set of proposals that will prevent taxpayer money from being used. Members say, oh, this requirement that it come from the financial industry, that won't work. Congress will do it instead. They have a very different Congress in mind than the one I have served in. I do not believe there's any remote chance that Congress would come to the rescue of the financial industry as this bill will have required and instead substitute taxpayer money. If that's their intention, they can try. I think they'll be outvoted if they feel that's what has to happen.
Barney Frank will be with us Monday, but Ann Kornblut, he's saying, in effect, we don't have an option here. But really? Really? If they fail again, Congress would just let it go down? Wouldn't it be the same old we must dynamic?
I think it's hard to imagine. I think he has to say that now, obviously, that, and given the public outrage over the bonuses now, I think there's nothing else he could say, and I do think he genuinely believes it, and that it's also a negotiating tactic. But it's hard to imagine at this point that if there were another failure that Congress would let it go. But that's why you see them, I think, trying to stave that off, that possibility.
Let's go to Mark in Columbia, South Carolina. Mark, you're on the air.
How you doing, Tom? Really, I don't believe that the recession is necessarily over, but only for the ones that actually created the recession or started a recession by having the deficits up so high, and there's no surplus, and now if they really stop crunching so many numbers and start looking at the people who are without jobs, who had good jobs, paying their taxes, and stop looking at it as a number thing, they can really see where we are really at, because it's still a recession for the ones without jobs and the ones who are still struggling to make it from day to day to support their families. And we just really need to look at people versus these numbers.
Mark, we hear you loud and clear. Jack Beatty, it is a very interesting point here where the sort of glamorous magazine covers about big money are gone. You know, you can have growth come back, but you've got so many people out of work that they're looking with a very jaundiced eye at this. If they don't feel it, they don't believe it. The hubba hubba isn't exactly working at all here.
Not at all. And, you know, the Peter Hart Associates did a survey this week. They asked voters who they felt was benefiting from the government's economic policies, precisely the question that Mark raises. And only 13% of people felt that average Americans were being helped by the government's policies, helped a lot or a fair amount by the government's policies. That's a failure. Now, I don't think that's true, by the way. I think the government's policies have helped average people, but that's a failure of political salesmanship that really could be punished by the electorate, unless they get it, that all this is that even the banks, what they have done with the banks has helped ordinary people, then there's going to be a political price to pay.
Let's get a call here from Lawville, New York. Charles. Charles, you're on the air. What do you see this week?
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd like to know what the panel thinks. The military is going to receive a 3% increase in their pay, which they more than deserve. But Social Security people are not going to receive any increase in pay. And I was wondering what the panel thinks of this and the rationale behind it, please. And I'll take the
Thanks, Charles. Howard Fineman, everybody's fighting over a limited pie here. Charles has got a little resentment over that military pay increase. Of course, it's hard to feel that way when you see the death toll out of Afghanistan, just for starters.
Well, I don't think anybody begrudges the soldiers their increase in pay. The problem with Social Security is that it's pegged to inflation rates, and there essentially wasn't any. That's the problem. That's why the president said that there would be a $200 check cut for every Social Security recipient to kind of salve the wound, if you will.
Just a little,
Just a little. That's the situation, and I don't think it's going to change, because the fact is that the government officials are now seriously worried about deficit matters. Geithner, Summers, the president, they get it. They get it. And while they're simultaneously arguing for the health care bill, which it is hoped will save money in the long run, they've begun to worry, and they're not going to, I don't think, spend any more capital beyond the $200 per person on changing that number.
The open spigot isn't there. Don in Dayton, Ohio. Don, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
My question on the health care is that if on the bill, Nancy Pelosi is stating that you're going to offer more and less payment into it, and the initial amount of funds, of course, is going to be coming from the taxpayers to support this operation. But in the long run, if you're going to offer more and pay less, and sooner or later you're going to run out. It's just plain economics. And I just don't understand how over the 10-year period where they said only $900 billion, it's got an increase just the same as Social Security when it came out underneath FDR, said it would only take up 2% of your pay, and now it's up to 6% by the employer and the employee.
Don, it's a good question. Our time is short. It's a good question. Jack Beatty, how about it? More health care coverage, but we're going to save money. A lot of people may scratch their heads at that.
Indeed, and one reason is that it's going to be funded, of course, by premiums. That is to say, the people are going to be essentially it's going to be premium funded.
You'll feel it. In other words, you'll know where that's
yes,
coming from.
Yes. But the subsidies to people who don't have insurance, those are going to come out of the public. exchequer, but how? The House wants essentially to rely on a tax, a surtax on, quote, millionaires, and the Senate, being peopled with millionaires, doesn't want that. The Senate wants instead to tax, quote, Cadillac insurance plans. And I think there's a big, big conflict there between the two. I can't imagine the Senate voting for the tax on the millionaires, and I can't imagine and in the House, there are over 100 House members who say they will never buy the Cadillac, the tax on the Cadillac insurance plans. So they're at loggerheads.
And there's a bunch of callers I can't even get to here asking about H1N1, saying what's up with the very spotty availability of this vaccine. We were told very clearly by the administration, by Kathleen Sebelius, we're going to be fine. We'll have plenty of vaccine. It's not there. What's going on, Ann?
Well, that's right. And I can tell you, certainly in the Washington area, where we've been following people's attempts to get it for their children, it's been tough. There have been very long lines, people even waiting overnight to try and get it, and there is a shortage. I'm not even talking about the regular population at this point. We're just talking about the highest risk groups at this point. The bottom line is that the vaccine wasn't able to be produced in the numbers that they thought. And at each juncture along the way, it's been either at a half or a quarter of what they thought it would be. They say now that they have turned a corner and that they're producing about 2 million per day, 2 million vaccines, a steady stream at this point. And they're saying also, the White House is saying, they will ramp up in November. But they are well aware that the shortage is not popular and has people very concerned.
What do you say of the Secretary Sebelius there, Jack? Which way should she turn?
She should turn to the history books and go to Chester Nimitz at Pearl Harbor when the Yorktown came in. They said, it'll take 3 weeks to fix this carrier. He says, you've got 3 days. They did it in 3 days. We won the Battle of Midway because of it. That's how an executive needs to act.
The 3 days are behind us now. However, the flu season is upon us. Jack Beatty, great to have you. Howard Fineman with Newsweek, author of the 13 American Arguments. Always great to have you, Howard. Thanks for being
here. Thank you very much.
And Kornblut, author of Notes from the Cracked Ceiling, out soon. And thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.